Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP. Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet. This is episode 114 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. Happy Saturday. How are you?
Fantastic. I just got finished doing some political business.
I was going to ask you, did you fly? Are your arms tired, or were you driving? Were you all over the state? What's up?
Yeah, just some pre-primary stuff that we have to do that for those who were active in their ward level politics. And I got some training on how to conduct the elections that we're doing next week and the following 2 weeks later.
Did you guys have an app?
We're probably not going to follow. Probably not going to follow that model.
I did want to ask you about that. What do you have a take on what happened in Iowa?
I do not. I don't understand it. I know that the national party chair was expressing that it can never happen again, but I don't understand what happened.
I all I know is that the app, which seems to me to be something like it's not. It doesn't seem complicated to me to say, okay, here's the precinct. You fill out your precinct number and you write in who had what votes. It doesn't seem like that would be that very complicated. It's not even like you've got, can you imagine conducting an election and you have a very small window and you have to bring in 100 million something votes, 120 million people's votes? Your system would be very seriously stressed. But there's not that much going on in Iowa that they would need some big Google-sized system to handle an election of so many delegates. It doesn't seem like it would be that hard. But anyway, the system failed, apparently. Anyway, did you hear a chuckle in the background?
I did.
I heard a chuckle.
Do we have Ghost in the room?
No, we have a guest. We have a guest. It is Josh Ho from the Decarceration Nation podcast joining us. Josh, how are you?
I'm good, Andy. How are you doing, man?
I'm very well. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, no problem.
You are like Mr. Twitter. That's what I refer to you as.
I was just thinking when you were talking about Iowa is that, you know, there was this great kind of all the experts on breaking, you know, the people who do the hardcore number crunching for all the different newspapers and all the different media outlets were getting together and pointing out all the mistakes in the tabulations, and Iowa was refusing to correct them.
Oh,
they were all getting increasingly frustrated throughout the entire process because there were clearly mistakes and the Iowa Democratic Party was refusing to acknowledge any of them. I just remember watching this in real time. It was pretty interesting to watch.
The other thing that happens to me, like in my day job, I can only test something so far before I have to I'm just going to throw this out there into the wild and I'll let the chips fall where they may. And either I have to pull it back and not use it but these are not you know, it's not life or death, certainly, and it's not life or death for an election, but they're kind of important that you wouldn't want to have anything get messed up like this. And maybe you would run the old system in parallel with the new system to make sure that everything is exactly copacetic, kosher, pick your word there.
Well, there's some candidates and some campaigns spent, you know, 6-7 months on the ground there. Spending millions of dollars to have the whole thing
to have everyone, to everyone just be like, don't really know. Anywho, tell me what your most recent interview was on the on DN.
Oh, that's a good question. I guess I had a kind of famous activist who participated in everything from Occupy the CIA to Occupy Wall Street to Standing Rock to, you know, she wrote a pretty relatively famous activist named Lisa Fithian, who wrote a book called, I think it's Light It Up or Tear It Down or something like that. I've forgotten the name of the book, which is terrible, but it was a really interesting interview. And she's really, you know, one of those people who's been on the ground in all of the big actions that have happened over the last, you know, 2 or 3 decades. So it's pretty fascinating to talk with her.
Awesome. And where do people find that just before we move on?
You know, you can find it at Decarceration Nation at, essentially on iTunes, Google Play, all the normal places, really anywhere you find podcasts.
Sweet.
Drugs are bad. You shouldn't do drugs. If you do them, you're bad. Because drugs are bad, okay? It's a bad thing to do drugs, so don't be bad by doing drugs, okay? That'd be bad. But drugs are bad.
Larry, we are going to dive in, and I totally just wanted to leave this in there. This has nothing to do with the registry, anything like that, but this leads me down the path of, you have a certain set of rules, like just sort of like generalized rules that you live by. So this first article comes from the Associated Press. It says, package labeled bag full of drugs leads to Florida arrests. And I'm pretty sure that you put this one in there. What was this article about?
Oh, well, I do have that. Since I'm in criminal defense, I always like to learn from what I see as very unwise choices. Criminality is unwise to begin with, but if you're going to engage in it, you ought not to make such stupid mistakes. But so I have general rules that I'll tell people. If you're going to do certain things, you know, don't do this and don't do that. It's just learning from what others have done. But as a general rule, I would recommend, this comes out of Florida. This two guys were under supervision, and they were driving 95 miles per hour on I-10. Now, anybody who's driven on Interstate 10 in Florida realizes that it's a congested thoroughfare with lots of traffic, and you're going to kind of, if you're lucky enough to run 95, you're probably going to be spotted anyway. And so when they pulled over, then when their NCIC check comes back to under supervision, then they are asked, do they mind if they search the car? And of course they say, we'd rather you not. So they bring the dogs in, and the dogs alert, and they find a package that says drug package. And it just had a list of drugs you wouldn't believe of what they said they recovered. I don't even know the names of some of them, but so I would recommend that if you're going to run drugs, and I would prefer that you don't, but if you are going to, don't drive 95 miles an hour. That would be my first advice to you. And if you are going to drive 95 miles an hour with drugs, don't label the package drug package.
Might as well just put, like, I don't know, paint your car orange and say drug runner right here on the side of it, perhaps. I can't really, this one's just really too funny for me. And I just want to leave it in there for the comedic value.
Well, I mean, that one was about like the it's not on the same scale, but the guy who killed the person and put him in the barrel under his house and left the person under there 30 years and forgot about it, and he sold the house. And
whoops.
At least that one had a, you know, time frame. You know, you had some time between the.
So, and the rule that I would recommend on that, if you have put a person in a barrel, and I don't recommend this either, but if you do kill a person and you do put them in a barrel and you do keep them under your house for 30 years, when you sell the house, take the barrel with you.
All right. I honestly think that we could talk about this for a really long time, but I'm going to end up with a bellyache from laughing for so long. But I think we should move on. We kicked this article back to, we just didn't have enough time last week. And there isn't much to go over with this, but it comes from ProPublica. And the title of it is about, they've compiled a list of quote unquote credibly accused clergy. And I'm pretty sure that this flies in the entire face of anything that would be due process. And I just wanted to cover it from and get a more elaborate sense of terminology and what is so deeply wrong with this, that ProPublica, which I really respect. I like what they do a great, great deal, but this one seems highly misguided.
Well, this is clergy abuse, and it does cause me great consternation. And this will be interpreted as that I want to sweep abuse under the rug. No, I don't. But this is the church, the Catholic Church, released a list of credibly accused of misconduct. And some of them are dead, and some are out of the ministry. But they've released this list. And I've always grown to believe that until recently, that personnel records are largely private. So if a person has an issue of some sort of misconduct on the job, that's normally not broadcast to the world. And since these people have not been accused of a crime in a formal setting, we normally don't even release the names of people who haven't been formally charged. which means that I believe that the Catholic Church has capitulated to all the pressure that they've been under as a result of all these crushing numbers of lawsuits and multi-millions of dollars that they've paid out in settlements and in attorney's fees to try to do something to satiate the mob, the angry mob out there. And there's a justification for being angry. For years and years, the Catholic Church just moved these abusers around and they sent them off to Glorieta, New Mexico, or wherever that Servants of the Paraclete's Rehabilitation Center was. And then they put them in another parish and they started up the same thing they had done before. But you don't fix a problem by blowing up our whole system. And that's what I think that this list is. That's why I wanted it in here, is to say I find this list very disturbing.
Josh, I'm sure you have something to add.
You know, I mean, all of these things, you know, I mean, there's such a, you know, for me, the big one is the victims' rights law that they're passing all over the country.
Marcy's law.
I mean, that's the one that always just drives me absolutely batty, because, you know, I mean, the parties the victim is not a party in the case, you know. And so, I mean, there's all these things about due process that, you know, and just the whole notion of, you know, what's private and what's public and how you deal with the courts and all these things that just seem to get ignored in kind of the rush to, you know, these kind of sex panic moments. And in the case of the Catholic Church, it's not, you know, it's been a long unfolding crisis. And so it's not, you know, I wouldn't say it's a panic in the same way, but it's certainly, you know, I mean, yeah, things should be done about the, you know, the horrible things that happen. But like Larry said, I don't think the way you go about it is by burning down the system.
So we agree on one thing tonight.
Uh-oh, watch out. Okay.
One we agree about agreement. A lot of stuff, Larry.
I'm gonna keep a tally on this side. So we have, on the side of agree versus disagree, we have one for agree.
We always suspect that the police stage crime in our area, but the antennas have went up like, hey, we can't trust the cops.
And then over at Reason.com, we have an article that's undercover cops hired 118 handymen, then arrested them all for not having licenses. And I'm pretty sure, I'm going to say that this is, what's the word? Entrapment. And Larry's going to say, no, it's not. But it seems, God, this is very, very much like bait and switch. This is, I mean, isn't this the equivalent of almost like the sexting stuff, Larry?
This is actually getting a lot closer to entrapment than things we've talked about previously. The dividing line is going to be, and this goes to my basic belief that law enforcement has too many resources, and I keep saying this over and over again, and people get so angry with me that I have to duck the rotten tomatoes that are hurled at me when I say this. But this is Hillsborough County. I believe that's Tampa, Florida. Where they ran the sting. But the where you're going to have entrapment potential is there are things that handymen can do, and this is their title, not mine, because I know this is you're supposed to be gender neutral. So when you hire a handy person, there are a lot of things that a handy person can do that doesn't require license. But then what often happens, and it's eliminated in the article, is that while you've got the person there, then you start asking them if they'll do additional things.
Okay.
And often the handy person will say, well, yeah, I know how to do that. Well, by then you've got a rapport with them because you've done a good job on picking up the weeds outside and cutting off the branches on the pyracantha tree, and you've done the basic stuff, and there's a rapport developed, and the person says, well, by the way, I've got this faucet here in the bathroom, it's dripping. Can you put? Well, maybe you don't need a license for. But in some jurisdictions, the most basic plumbing you need a license if you're going to do it for someone other than yourself. So that person is all of a sudden put in a position. Well, this thing's dripping here down here at the toilet. Turn off. Can you replace this for me? Well, yeah, I know how to do that. I've done several of them, and they end up doing those things, and then they say, "I got you."
Right. Okay.
Well, there's where the entrapment is. That person, depending on what ad they answered to show up, which I don't see those details here in the story, but depending on what ad they answered, if they answered an ad to do drywall repair, for example, and then they were confronted with a plumbing issue that required a license, and they had no intention to go out and do plumbing work without a license, they might have been entrapped. If they, on the other hand, if the ad was less clear that there's odd jobs to be done, And the person calls, if anybody actually makes a phone call anymore, and said, I can help you. And they say, by the way, I've got some plumbing work. And don't you supposed to have a license for that? And yeah, but the police ain't gonna have time to watch this kind of thing. I'll come over there and I'll come over and fix your toilet. I'll put a new wax ring in. Then that's where it's not entrapment. If the person had the mindset to break the rules, knowing what they were, and they go out with the intent of breaking the law.
I have a question for you. Are you ready for this question?
I'll try.
Do you have a plumbing license to change out the showerhead?
Well, I'm doing that for myself.
Okay. All right. Josh, so, you had a question. I heard it coming.
Yeah. I mean, isn't the problem also that in a lot of cases, in the kind of last several decades of all the kind of rolling back the protections on this stuff, that a lot of entrapment is actually legal anyway. Like the notion that the fact that something's entrapment is problematic. I think to us, we probably think that's true, but I don't think legally it's always the case. Am I wrong about that, Larry?
You're absolutely right. The legal test is whether the person was predisposed to break the law. If you go out looking, and trying to keep this a family program, if you're going out looking to have sexual favors and you're willing to pay for it, and you make an offer to someone who happens to be a cop, your predisposition was to break the law because you know that you're not supposed to pay for sex. On the other hand, if the cop comes up to you and you have no inclination to have sex and they say, I can make you have a fun evening. Oh yeah. What could you do? You know what fun is. You're a healthy young man, aren't you? For $20, we could have a lot of fun. Well, if you had no predisposition to break the law, and the cop is the instigator of breaking the law, then you have a defense of entrapment that just might work. But most of the time, the person's predisposed to break the law, and that's why their entrapment defense breaks down, because they were already predisposed to do something that was unlawful.
Well, there's a fairly famous case where the FBI convinced a bunch of people they were basically doing this. They were going around to mosques, and they eventually found some people that they convinced, in essence, to commit a crime, provided them all the weapons for it. And then when they went to go pick them up to go commit the crime, they arrested them all. There's a documentary about it. I forget the name of the exact case, but where it seemed pretty clear that they didn't necessarily even have the intent to ever commit a crime. But still, because of the nature of the crime, the entrapment wasn't. I'm sure you're right about that. I just remember reading about cases where even that wasn't necessarily held to be enough to throw the case out or whatever. Does that ring a bell for you at all, Larry? Or?
It doesn't ring a bell. But you can't let the entrapment get to a jury. If you let the entrapment get to a jury. If you can't get the judge to find it on some preliminary motion that this, even if you stipulate everything is true, that this was entrapment because the person wasn't predisposed to commit the crime until the law enforcement initiated the idea and participated in the planning and the motivation. If it gets to a jury is normally not sympathetic. They should be because these are their resources being wasted. I mean, this is Hillsborough County, which I think is Tampa. And I'm sure Tampa probably has other things to do other than chasing handyman that are doing things without a license. But on the other side of that coin, there are people elderly in Hillsborough County that are being victimized by folks who don't have the proper licenses and are going out and charging people money to do things that they're not qualified to do. And they're either not doing the job or they're doing a botched up job. And so that does necessitate some level of intervention. What the right level of intervention is always a judgment call by the people who decide how to allocate those resources. But this seems like a significant intervention. They must have a big problem with unlicensed people in Hillsborough County.
They got a whole 118 of them. Who knows how many didn't get caught, because they didn't respond to that particular Craigslist ad or whatever that was.
Well, one of the defense attorneys said that the smarter ones don't respond to this kind of stuff. These were the rookies.
Oh,
so there were so many of them that 118 of them got swept
and those are the stupid ones or less sophisticated. I don't mean to call them stupid per se, but less sophisticated.
Probably not as stupid as the people who drove down the thing in the street with the drugs and the
definitely not that needed. And they put their bags, the drugs in a bag that says drugs here. God, I can't. That one. Well, that one makes me giggle.
Well, I made a joke. I wonder if I took my vehicle that I currently drive and either had it wrapped by a professional or if I just had some signage made that said drug running machine and started driving it around here, I wonder if I would get any attention.
You should get a vanity plate that says drug R&R or something like that, drug runner.
So
you think they would let that, like, you should try and go get that vanity plate, Larry. That would be funny.
I don't think they would give you that one.
You got to figure out a way to obfuscate it so that they don't pick up on it.
So, but yes, I am sympathetic to people who are being taken advantage of by unscrupulous. But I'm not sure that this rose to that level. I'd have to know. I'd have to be on the defense team on this to see what the real facts are. But it to run a sting like that where you bring in 100 plus people, that's an enormous amount of personnel it takes to put that together.
But Larry, you don't want these people out there in the civilian sector. You don't want people that are calling to have a faucet replaced or a socket put in. You don't want them to have some shoddy work and that makes their house burn down from a short in the electrical socket. That's why we need strong regulations.
Well, there's some truth in that.
You don't want the big bad government stifling that small entrepreneur from rising up to be successful and picking himself up by his bootstrap all by himself.
Well, that is the careful balance. Absolutely. We do want people to be able to be creative and go out and offer services and work with their hands and do things. Absolutely, we want, but we don't want people to go out and do complex stuff in a shoddy fashion that they're not qualified to do and charge people for it and leave them with shoddy work or either dangerous. I mean, it's regulation is always a careful balancing. People think that this is simple. It's not. Everybody who agrees that some regulation is necessary. Almost everybody agrees some regulation is necessary. Trying to figure out where to strike the balance is always the tough thing of how far do we go with regulation before we are intruding. I find it frustrating myself with some things when I'm dealing with, we go on the whole podcast and some of the bureaucracies I have to deal with here in terms of complying. And I say, wow, that no wonder businesses are so frustrated. But this stuff comes about because self-regulation has proven not to be successful when you allow people to do what they want to do.
I guess on the other extreme of that, I mean, you do like, I mean, to pose as a handyman, you may have taken classes while you're in prison and you know how to do these things, or you got taught by your dad, whatever. And not to make a gender thing, maybe your mom taught you, but you could have somebody that's actually saying, sure, I can install a socket, and they've never done it before and literally just walk in there trying to steal people's money. Like, I mean, that's the far extreme of some doofus showing up that doesn't even know which way the light socket goes.
There's a larger issue here, too, which is that a very large amount of all construction work and plumbing work and electrical work all gets done under the table. And so a lot of this may be actually in good faith, and it's just not, you know, these are people who actually know what they're doing. They just tend to work under the, you know, not in an official capacity in the way that the law would like for them to. So they might not be, they might do good work. They're just not doing, they're just not officially licensed or whatever. That especially in construction areas, that happens a great deal. It doesn't mean that they have malintent per se, but there's still an interest for the state to regulate that stuff, at least theoretically.
Well, and Josh, that's a fantastic point because I, living in a border state, there are a lot of folks here who provide those type of services, and they do some fantastic work, but they can't get licensure for various reasons. They may have a criminal record. They may be here illegally, but they may be a very good skill. Their skills may be second to none, but they're not able to operate legally. It's kind of the debate we had about driver's licenses for illegals, and we ended up losing that debate. We were one of the few states that actually gave illegals driver's licenses. We made the argument that since it's a regulatory scheme to license people, and in order to have your vehicle insured, you have to have a valid driver's license. It's very difficult to find an insurance carrier that will insure a non-licensed driver. I mean, try it one day and find out how far you get with that. And so we made the argument that to bring more people into the insurance structure, that we needed to give them licenses to make them authorized to drive. Well, the other side says, well, if you do that, they'll come in by the tens of thousands, and they'll devastate all of our social service infrastructure, and that all those costs will outweigh they bringing down the rate of uninsured. Well, like I said, we lost that debate, and we no longer issue. We will issue a permit that's different from a license. But that's kind of the whole idea behind that, was to bring these people into the system. I feel the same thing. People here working illegally, I want their tax money.
Mm-hmm.
I want them in the system. I want them to be participating in the system and paying for the benefits and privilege of being in this country.
There's actually another reason why that stuff happens, which is that people don't want to pay full price for their repairs. It's not just that they're being taken advantage of.
Correct.
Do you think there's any angle for the homeowner or the person that's hiring the unauthorized, unlicensed work? Is there any culpability on their side?
Josh just makes a good point. I'm culpable of that. When I call around and get estimates, I like the one from the unlicensed generally a whole lot better. It's a more attractive proposal. I did about $15,000 worth of work on my house, and I actually used the licensed everything. And I assure you that $15,000 would probably drop to at least two thirds of that if I'd used somebody who didn't have a license a couple of years ago.
So does that mean you have to go to jail because you would have hired not you, somebody else? Since you didn't hire somebody that wasn't licensed. Do you think the homeowners have any culpability there?
Well, that's hard to say in terms of whether you should insist on a license or whether you should be prosecuted if you don't. I don't know. I'll have to think about that.
All right. Well, I'll ask you next week.
I'm for reforming our criminal justice system. Too many people are locked up in America.
Let's talk about an article from the New York Times with a jailed woman in need of cancer surgery moved to state prison. She got sentenced for like some 10 months in jail for, Larry, she got sentenced to 10 months in jail for $109. I will say that she does have a history of theft convictions in the past several years. So, but like, do we not have any compassion for someone to stay with their doctors that know the case, that are actually they've worked through the process of treating and so forth, the diagnosis and all that stuff, that they would be the most experienced persons to handle the cancer treatment? But now she's in jail in prison.
Well, you did lay the story out correctly. It's a very short story, but from what we have here, this was a 10-month sentence for a theft of a person who has a history of previous convictions. But I always like to apply an economic analysis to this. If I'm a jail administrator, if I'm a corrections administrator, I do not want to take care of people's medical unless I have to. So if I'm looking at this roster of inmates, and I've got a person who's got a relatively modest offense, and they even though they've repeated it, I would rather not spend our resources on them. So I'm going to be looking for a way to get them out of custody, which it sounds like exactly what they did. They got them shipped off to state prison.
So the county just kicked the can down the road to the state.
You've just explained how most funding issues work out in the state, in most states, between the counties and the states.
It would have, in most states, it would have to have been a felony level offense, because in most states they don't send misdemeanors to the state correction system. Those are usually served in local jails.
Since felony generally means a year. Yeah, but there are certainly misdemeanors that can get you in prison, I think, in most places. Is that wrong?
Well, no, they get you incarcerated, but normally in most states you serve misdemeanor time. If that's your highest level offense, you're likely to serve that.
Yeah, because the misdemeanor's under a year. You're right.
Right. Now, she only got 10 months, but 10 months doesn't mean that's all. It's whether it's a felony offense. If you have a felony and they sentence you to less than a year, you can still go off to prison in my state for that conviction, because you've been convicted of felony. You belong to the Department of Corrections. But it sounds like that the jail administrator there locally in Lebanon County got rid of her and got her off to state prison by whatever. It'd be interesting to know if she was a person who legitimately should have been in state prison, because if that was a misdemeanor, $109 is a pretty low level for a felony.
Well, just think about the cost, the relative cost between the time for that $109 to protect people from her stealing that $109. You're probably a year in most state facilities is like $30,000. And then you've got the medical treatment on top of that, which in theory could have been handled, I think, in some states would become a Medicaid thing outside, but maybe not when you're in. So cost benefit analysis doesn't work very well for the state on any either.
No, that's what I'm saying. As a corrections administrator, I would be wanting to get this person off of our books in every way possible. Now, Larry, don't you understand? If we had a system like that everybody would magically become sick and everybody would fake that they have these medical needs, and we'd be having the floodgates open of people who would be released from prison, and they would all flood in and try to use the same. I mean, Larry, don't you understand that? That's what the people out there would say in counter to my position. They would say that it would open the floodgates.
Except, you know, we have Medicaid expansion, for instance, in Michigan, and pretty much everyone I know who comes out of prison applies for Medicaid expansion when they come out of prison or jail here in Michigan. And the economic analysis that's been done afterwards says it actually has generated a lot more income than it's cost. But, you know.
Well, yeah, in particular, since the feds are paying for the bulk of it, of course it does.
Yeah, sure. But we are talking about state, how states cost benefit analysis. So,
yep, absolutely. But yeah, this is a bizarre thing.
I am still kind of conflicted on the side of it that, you know, you would have somebody say, "Well, you should have thought about that before you stole the $100." But I'm going to assume that she wasn't so well off that she did the $100 theft just because it was fun. She probably needed it, and I'm not saying that justifies the crime, but that puts into perspective that $100 could be some sort of life-changing monetary situation for her at that point, like, you know, for her food or diapers or, you know, whatever else is going on in that person's life at the time.
What if she was a kleptomaniac? You know, I mean, there are other things like that, and, you know, obviously being incarcerated didn't fix it. So my guess is that, you know, there's probably another solution that might work better. I mean, you might say that, well, you should have thought of that before, but that doesn't mean that either putting someone in jail or prison is the correct move from an economic perspective or from a deterrence perspective or from a solving the actual root problem perspective.
I thought prison solved all problems. Doesn't it, Larry? Come on.
It absolutely does for a temporary period of time.
Actually, that's not necessarily true. You know,
she could be a klepto in prison. She could be stealing soups from all kinds of people out of their locker boxes.
That's very true. Is one thing that doesn't get counted is the violence and crime that occurs in prison. That definitely tends to be undercounted because people think that that's justified. But in addition to that, the long-term studies suggest that the longer periods of time you spend in prison, the more likely you are to commit crimes when you come out, that they're criminogenic. In fact, I'm trying to remember where the study is from. I can probably find it and put it in your notes or something later. But one of the longest running studies says that that even accounting for incapacitation, which is what Larry just said, that prison actually generates more crime than it solves.
Oh, now that's a different discussion. But if you take a person who's doing things that are not acceptable to society as a whole. Now, the prisoners don't count in this analysis just for the purpose of whether it be making obscene telephone calls, whether it be embezzling from your employer, whatever you do, home burglaries, for the period of time that they are incarcerated doing hard time, they're not burglarizing, they're not making obscene telephone calls.
They can still do all those things in prison.
But I'm saying to society as a whole, to the people who are out working, paying the taxes and playing by the rules, it is stopping and providing a level of protection for the period of time. But it doesn't fix the long-term problem. If you've got a person who's making obscene telephone calls,
it can make the problems worse. Yeah.
It can do that. I'm not advocating the policy. I'm just saying it does work for the time the person is incapacitated. They're not doing those things to society as a whole.
Fair.
But it depends on how you define work, whether it's working. It is working in terms of stopping society from being victimized, but society is going to be victimized again when they come out because the underlying issues haven't been dealt with, and that's what we don't do very well in this country is figuring out. There are a lot of people who would not be committing crimes, but there are some people who would commit crimes regardless. I'm not naive enough to believe that they're just mean people out there. They are, but they're yeah. but the whole criminal population is not just mean people.
Oh, that's definitely true. But there's also like this thing that I think people miss a lot of times, which is that people don't necessarily stay mean people. You know, like one of the most common things that all studies show is that people tend to age out of crime. And so right. I personally, for example, know people who committed pretty brutal murders who ended up doing a lot of really good in the world. You know, I mean, it's to say that someone is always one thing is probably inaccurate, you know. And so, yeah, you know, I might meet someone when I was in prison and I was in prison. I would meet some people that scared the hell out of me, you know, but, you know, that doesn't mean they're ever always going to be that person or that they're beyond redemption or that they can't change. It also means it doesn't mean that they can't get worse. You know, I mean, the prison, you know, there is a lot of pressure for, you know, on people in prison in a lot of different ways. And it can make you, you know, I know a lot of people, for instance, get extorted into being parts of gangs and stuff like that. And they end up becoming much more violent. And then when they get out, they're much worse.
Absolutely. And we've talked about on this podcast about the aging out. That's why I don't believe in long, long periods of time of incarceration. I believe that for whatever benefit that prison can be had from prison, that benefit can be had in a much shorter period of time than what we impose in this country.
Hey, Larry and I agree again. Put that down on the board.
Oh, gosh, man, I kept keeping track because there was a lot of disagreements in there.
I definitely agree with that last one.
Let's move over to an article from what looks like 92.7 WOBM, Ocean Country's Best Variety. This goes with the next article, too, that Megan's Law Initiative introduced. They're trying to expand it. This particular article, they're increasing the advance notification that someone in your area is going to be moving in. So they're going to notify people by email when someone gets a new address or they change their zip code. The registry has been shown to not increase public safety. It increases certainly people's anxiety over it, increases violence against those that are listed on those websites. But yet here we are getting more and more registry notifications and like further entrenching this whole thing in our culture. And it seems like a bad plan to me.
This is out of New Jersey, isn't it?
I have absolutely no doubt. If it is where the schmuck that created the whole thing started, then that would be. But this is Ocean County Senator Chris Connors. It could be Jersey. I don't know where it is.
Well, what do you
know? I will look. I know how many days there are in a week. How do these things keep happening though, Larry? That they how would the government have the resources and what's the word I'm looking for? The mechanisms to employ getting email notifications out to the citizenry that someone has changed their address in their neighborhood.
Well, you're probably better qualified than me to answer that. But on the technological thing, I'm assuming that when you do your updates with the brilliant technology we have today, either a clerk at the registry office, if they require in-person notification, or in the rare instance where you might be able to go online and update your information yourself, I'm guessing what the person would do would be like they do in state prison systems, where you sign up for alerts when the person's going to be eligible for a parole hearing or when they've been released or when their institution assignment's been changed. I'm guessing what would happen would be that you would sign up for an alert notification as a person who's interested in that particular offender. And then I'm supposing what would happen would be when a change was either manually input by law enforcement or by the registrant, that would trigger an alert to the people who had signed up for them. That would be one way I'd visualize it would work.
Yeah, I was just going to say, in most places, it's an opt-in system, so I think Larry's right on.
So Ocean County is in the southeast corner-ish of the state of New Jersey.
I thought so. But yeah, I would say it would be an opt-in thing where people would sign up for it, and then as the changes were made, they would just go out in the form of a blast to anybody who's on that offender's watch list.
I have an idea then. So the citizenry should boycott this system. The registrant should go door to door knocking, say, hi, I think that you should oppose the system and you should opt out. And then they wouldn't have any blast go out.
Well, if you never opted in, I guess you would officially be opted out, wouldn't you?
Oh, that's totally true. But I'm assuming that people would be running to go opt into this because they have to be notified of the impending doom of having a registrant move into their neighborhood.
Well, play devil's advocate, which gets me in trouble, of the people who have been victimized. And I don't consider a lot of things on the registry to, I consider them to be victimless crimes. I don't consider indecent exposure to have a true victim. I don't consider sex where they're close in age and one happens to be a few days under 18 and one is a few days over 19. I don't consider that. But where there's actually been a brutal attack and there's been a victimization and the person has done their time and they've been rightfully released into community, is it possible that the person who was the victim of that offense would feel some at ease knowing where the person is in proximity to them? I mean, is it remotely possible that that would be helpful to them?
I think that the person may feel better, but that's just that's just the warm and fuzzy. But it doesn't, I mean, they could just actively go check the quote unquote, the website looking for that information to find them.
But what,
or they could hire a private investigator so that they know their whereabouts at all times.
But wouldn't it be far less expensive if the person is a great distance away from them? Say a state that has like 58,000 something square miles that you live in, and 159 counties. If they were living down in the southern part of the state, and the victim was living up in the northern part of the state in Catoosa County, and all of a sudden that person moved into Catoosa, and it wouldn't have to be an adult with an adult victim. It could be where there was a child victim, where there was actually a forceful. I mean, there are forceful sex acts that do occur on children. They're not as rampant as we would like, as the media would like for us to believe. But would it not possibly provide some reassurance to that family if they knew when that person was getting closer to them? I'm not advocating this. I'm just saying, is it not possible?
We know that you are the stealth supporter of these laws. Wouldn't it be possible then for the judge to, could it even be, so I know the judge could banish a person from a county or a handful of ones.
So we're getting into some tricky places here because, you know, I'm not sure that the point, I mean, this is like one of the, and Larry, I know you probably deal with a lot too, since you work, with the legislature a lot, but there's these certain things that become like magic words and start seeping in and everyone starts believing them. Like essentially that whatever the victims advocates groups say is the way it should be, you know, and I'm not entirely sure that someone's liberty should be constrained based on the idea that it might make someone else more or less comfortable once they've already served their time. I'm kind of the belief that once you've paid your debt and move on, you know, and so at least to take your hypothetical situation, it seems to me, I'm not so sure that, I mean, while it is nice to make people more comfortable, I'm not so sure that, you know, you should constrain people's liberty and privacy and, you know, so maybe you should. I'm playing devil's advocate.
Well, we have two devil's advocates playing against each other.
I agree with you on the liberty. The person should be able to move right across the street from the person. In America, if you've paid your debt to society, you should be able to live wherever you want to. But then the question becomes, we've accepted this, that people have the right to know. I mean, I disagree with that also. But since that's ingrained in every sex offender, when asked, don't they have a right to know? They all inevitably say yes, but to the extent that there's no intrusion in terms of them not being allowed to move there, if they're just simply the person who signed up to be alerted that you're going to be there, just simply gets the information, then the only other issue implicated would be your right to privacy, which is a significant right. That is a significant right of privacy.
What's part of your liberty?
That's the whole thing. But the Supreme Court has said that a person who has been convicted of a crime doesn't have the right to privacy.
Well, they didn't say you don't have any right to privacy.
Well, they said if you've been convicted of a sex crime, in Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe, they said that you didn't have the right to any privacy in terms of that conviction. And they said that criminal records in general are public unless they've been suppressed or expunged or one of those things. So the fact of the matter is, I agree that we've gone down a slippery slope, but devil's advocate, it might help the victim. If that's what we're in this for, which is, seems to be that that's a big part of, even people on our side say that I'm all for the victims. Wouldn't this help conceivably some victims?
Oh, I definitely agree. It would probably help. I'm not sure that, I guess what my devil's advocate be all for the victims, that we should be, you know, cope. I mean, we definitely should be trying to, you know, make the world as good as it can be for victims, but not at the, necessarily at the expense of personal liberty.
Agree again, Josh. That's three or four, right?
Oh my gosh. It's going to be a tie before the end of the night.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
I want to bounce over to this other one because we're starting to run a little bit long and I want to get to this thing with Michigan. But this article comes from Patch.com, which we all know is our favorite publication for being honest and fair. But I specifically wanted to highlight in this article that, like, the way that they are coloring the effectiveness of the International Megan's Law from the previously mentioned schmuck named Representative Chris Smith from New Jersey, that he's the one that introduced International Megan's Law. But what they said is that the law is working, and in just about 2 years, 10,500 covered sex offenders had been noticed by the U.S. government to foreign countries, and 3,600 individuals as of July who were convicted of sex crimes against children were denied entry into those nations. But the false piece of information, like the information that isn't said there, is, were they traveling just to go on vacation, or were they traveling actually to commit some sort of sex crime, sex trafficking, whatever? And it doesn't say that. And I have another paragraph there to
also what the heck does working mean?
Right. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, you had some number, quote unquote, some number of sex trafficking that this law was introduced to stop. So that would be a number that I assume you could quantify. And then this law is enacted, and now this number is appreciably reduced to quantify that, yes, it is working. This whole thing is bullshit to me and really, really irritates me, because there's just like, hey, we're going to throw out these numbers to you, but they don't mean anything.
This might be another one that that we all agree on.
Damn it.
Because there's very few things that make me more angry than National Megan's Law. In particular, it makes me very angry because the whole purpose of the government's existence is essentially you enter into the social contract with the government, and they're part of what they're supposed to do is protect you when you travel abroad. And the whole point of International Megan's Law is that your government is working against your safety, which just is totally ridiculous to me. It's just like antithetical to everything that, why would I ever join in a contract as a, you know, with a government that's working against my safety? You know, I mean, it's just, I mean, it's just hard for me to explain how much International Megan's Law makes me angry.
You love it, well, don't you, Larry?
Well, I think that the key point of what he said is how you define working. And the way they're defining working, it's working exactly the way intended it to work. Well, you laugh all you want to, but what they intended to do was to provide the nation, for the nations of the world, to provide each other notice when people who had certain types of convictions were traveling. It's not a pronouncement that you're going to commit another crime. It's a pronouncement that this person is traveling. You can decide whether to admit them. You can decide whether to reject them. It's an information empowering thing, and it works both ways. The U.S. gets information from countries where people have been convicted of sex offenses or going to travel to the United States, and we choose not to admit them. Now, I'm not a big fan of marking passports and all this stuff, but if you want to say, is it working? Well, what it was intended to do was to give notice to foreign nations, to share a notice about a particular type of person who was traveling. Well, if this many notices have been sent, by de facto, it is working because that's what they intended it to do.
Yeah, I guess my point is that sharing of that information is antithetical to, in my opinion, the purpose of the government in terms of its relationship with its citizens, or at least its citizens that it's identifying.
There's another paragraph in there that is completely pointless. It says, for example, at least 4,500 U.S. passports were issued to registered sex offenders in 2008 alone. Also, passports last for 10 years. Like, okay, who cares? What does that mean? What does that tell us?
Well, what on the 4,500 passports, what he's telling you is he's trying to, the writer of that's trying to tell you that if it's 4,500 in 1 year, that you can extrapolate in the years that's passed how many sex offenders have gotten passports. And what they're trying to convey is that these people will be traveling now with more information available to the nations, to the host nations they're traveling to about what things they've done in the past. That's all they're conveying to you. I don't support this. I was dead set against it. Remember, it was the Republican Congress that passed this. For 8 years, he tried to get this passed, and he couldn't. But he got it passed in 2016. And if you define working as far as what he intended to do, it's working exactly as he intended it.
We're just, you're setting the bar stupid low for working as being that they just are announcing our arrival to a foreign nation.
Well, but you're overlooking the part that foreign nations are announcing arrivals to us. That's the part that all Americans seem to overlook. It's not just the U.S. isn't the only country that's participating in this. The U.S. is on the receiving end of notices also, not as many, because countries...
I agree with what you're saying, Larry. I think my point is just that we don't have a contractual relationship, just a social contractual relationship with people from other countries. We may benefit from getting that information, but in order to get that information, we've essentially made U.S. citizens hostage, in a sense, to getting that information. And I know you don't necessarily disagree. I'm just clarifying.
Yeah. Well. Arguably, if we're keeping out bad folks that would do bad things in America, good things are happening for our population as well, right?
Sure. I don't necessarily disagree with that. My point is that we have obligations. The government should have obligations to its citizens, regardless of the, you know, other consequences or whatever.
Well, Smith would argue that he's meeting that obligation. He's protecting Americans from bad people that would be coming here by entering into agreement to share information about bad people. He would tell you he's doing exactly that.
Oh, I know that's what he would say. I just disagree pretty vociferously that that's a appropriate use of the government powers, at least using that bargain.
It's a fate worse than death to put kids on the registry, and it never ends.
Let's bounce over to an article from Fox17.com. Out of Nashville, Tennessee teen rapist to be charged as adult. It's added to sex offender registry under bills. Pretty short article, but I figured it was right up your alley as far as certain states do nothing to charge minors as adults, and other states, in this particular case, this is a 13-year-old boy being convicted of something, and they're going to be charged as adults. Thoughts, Larry?
Well, it's a response to a situation where the judge sentenced them under the juvenile code, so it's one of those things to do a carve out to make sure that that doesn't happen again. It's correcting a non-existent problem, because a young person committed a heinous crime doesn't mean that you should scrap the juvenile code as it applies to people under 14. But that's what they're likely to do in Tennessee. It's going to be tough to stop this because you've got the sensationalization of the victims, of the family member of the high profile. I can't believe that's all they gave him. I can't believe that he got such a light sentence. And this is an overreaction, but I'd be surprised if they're able to stop it. It's two 13-year-old boys were convicted of holding down a Clarksville girl, raping her, and filming it. Just when the girl's family thought they would get justice, a judge handed down a sentence of only 6 months in juvenile detention for one boy and 6 months probation at home on the other. Neither boy was added to the state sex offender registry. Well, that's exactly what should happen to a 13-year-old. You shouldn't be added to the sex offender registry. Hello? Nobody should be added to it, but particularly a 13-year-old.
Josh, let me ask you this question. How much in your experience, do you think that the public as a whole does not understand what the impact of the registry is?
I think there's a lot of people who don't care what the impact of the registry is. They think every single person on it is convicted of the absolute worst thing, which I personally don't, you know, whatever people are convicted for, I think the registry is a bad idea. But, you know, a lot of people think that that's the case. And then I think there's a lot of people who have no idea. You know, I've anecdotally given speeches all over Michigan, not all over, but quite a few of them, where I talk to people about the registry, and I'd say, you know, well over 50% of the people at every event are surprised by something I say. I give a training for social workers pretty regularly, where I go through all the things that people, just the amount of things that people have to register and unregister, so that they understand how to work better with their clients who are on the registry. And they're always shocked. So, you know, I think there's a large amount of ignorance. And then I think there's also a percentage of the population who, you know, no matter how harsh it was, they wouldn't really care.
Yeah. They're like, it's not harsh enough. We need more.
I agree with Josh. I don't think that, I think the biggest percentage of people do not understand. But I think of the people who do not understand, there's a significant segment who could care less. It's like, don't tell me your problems. I've had people tell me when I start talking about conditions in jail and I start describing horrendous conditions, well, I don't care if they have to sleep standing up. But I tell them, we've got three people in a cell that was designed for one. And they said, well, I don't care if they sleep standing up. Well, that's kind of the attitude about the registry. Well, maybe it is bad in some regards. Don't tell me the problems. They should have thought about that. A 13-year-old can't think about such things. That is not going to be going through their analysis.
There's also so much evidence that suggests, I mean, especially with the juvenile life without parole cases before the Supreme Court, just all the evidence of how juvenile brains develop, and, you know, that there's a huge difference when you're that age as to your culpability and your ability to process information correctly, et cetera.
I think we've learned that it keeps going up to age 25 or before a person of particular male brain fully develops.
Present company.
Well, yeah, no, of course. Josh, give me the synopsis of what happened. What was it, Wednesday this week?
Well, hopefully everybody has some idea who listens to this show that there's been a very long, period of dealing with the Doe versus Snyder case here in Michigan, which was a victory for folks on the registry. And unfortunately, you know, the legislator didn't follow up after that was found unconstitutional and kind of make the changes that need to be made. So the ACLU went back through and did a class action suit. So, I mean, basically anyone who was on the registry who was impacted by Doe, if they were arrested, could probably use Doe's as precedent to, you know, get any of the chain, you know, if they were arrested, for instance, for, you know, any like a technical violation that was covered under Doe's or something like that, then you could use that as, you know, a reason for the court to let you out, but you still have to go through that process. So the ACLU went back through and decided to do a class action so that the original Doe's case, which I think only applied to six people, would be, you know, kind of universally applicable, and kind of hopefully force more change, or at least invalidate a large portion of the currently existing Michigan registry. And so that process has been winding its way through, and it's finally gotten to the district court. And the district court had its hearing on that case on Wednesday. And Judge Cleland heard the state's arguments and the ACLU's arguments, and that's where we're at.
And I think that, like, immediately goes to Larry, I have a question for you. What in the heck is severability? Like, because Josh just brought up about, like, you know, if a certain part, could we just like shut down the whole thing? Can you give me the rundown of what severability would mean?
Well, it's the doctrine of whether when you look at a statute, very few statutes just have one section. So if you were to look at the Michigan Registration Act, there would be a number of sections in the act. And they have their number generally, and they have, or there may be subsections. So it'll be section A1I or whatever. So the question becomes when you're talking severability, in the Doe versus Snyder, in the Sixth Circuit decision, all previous challenges against Michigan's registry had been found to be without merit, and that Michigan's registry was a civil, non-punitive regulatory scheme. But as in most states, they could not help themselves. So they kept adding. So in 1999, for example, the legislature added the requirement that sex offenders register in person, which it previously had not been in person, much like the Alaska scheme. And then in 2006, they amended their registration act to prohibit registrants from living within or lording within 1,000 feet of a school. And then they couldn't stop themselves there. Then they had the Adam Walsh Act, which Congress passed in 2006, that same year, and they decided to seek substantial compliance. So in 2011, they went and changed their registry in a dramatic fashion, and they added the tiers, and which resulted in a lot of people that were near the end of the registration having their terms extended, and they did the tiers based on the offense. And the inference to the population is that if you're a tier three, you're dangerous, but there's been no determination of that. It's just merely the offense of conviction. So the 2006 add-on, the 2011 add-on was what was so troubling to the 11th Circuit, because those were made retroactive. I mean, to the 6th Circuit, excuse me. Those two add-ons were what troubled the 6th Circuit panel when they said, no, you can't do that, at least retroactively. But then the question becomes, if you take those two sections out, do you have a surviving statute? Well, I say you would, because you had a surviving statute before those were put in. So it only stands to reason, unless you repealed the complete statute, which I don't know what they did in Michigan 2006-11, but I'm assuming that they just added in these requirements and they didn't repeal. But unless you repealed the complete Registry Act and implemented a new one, I would argue that if you simply strike those, you go back to what the registry looked like previously without those two add-ons. Well, my understanding is, from my conversations with the lead attorneys out of Michigan, was that they were hoping for something better in the way of improvement. That simply rolling those two things out and striking those still leaves a pretty bad registry in Michigan. And they were hoping for a grand improvement, that their theory, I think, was that once the legislature hears how bad this registry is and it gets stricken on constitutional grounds, that they're going to want to rise up to the challenge and they're going to want to develop a much more streamlined constitutional registry and make a better public policy choice. I never had great optimism that was going to happen. So we get back to this question about severability. Can this registration scheme survive legally if the court prohibits enforcement of those two provisions? That's where this case is headed. That's where it's ultimately going to be resolved, is what to do with the things that the court has found unconstitutional, what the remedy is. And we can talk a little bit more about remedies after I give a chance for Josh to jump in here.
Yeah, I was going to say, we have a few, I mean, we were talking about the recording, we have a few disagreements kind of about what's going on. But most of the stuff we probably are in some of the same places. I don't think, my understanding is that the court strategy by the ACLU is actually to try to force the legislature to change the statute, because the alternative would be that it would be mostly found, you know, struck. It would basically not exist functionally for people who were sentenced before 2011, which is when the Adam Walsh Act went into effect here. There's another set of requirements that were in an earlier decision by the same judge that just heard the case on Wednesday, that found that there were other reasons why that the registration was constitutionally problematic, mostly based in void for vagueness. So my understanding of what happened Wednesday is that the ACLU made the argument, and they literally took the statute and went through everything the Sixth Circuit said and went through everything Cleland said, and essentially showed how much would be marked out of the document, and what was left was nonsensical. And so their argument is that there is no more, I mean, the severability doctrine, the idea is that you're only supposed to get rid of what what's unconstitutional, and leave the rest to the will of the legislator. And in this case, there would be nothing left there that was functional. And so the idea is that, you know, rather than have the judge try to write something in there to make it work, you would leave it to the legislator to fix or invalidate it and give people injunctive relief until that point, which the legislator acts. That's kind of my understanding of what happened.
Is this something, Larry, where the legislature just wants to have the judge make a decision so they can be lazy?
Not really, although that's the cynic's view. First of all, it's not the judiciary. The judiciary is not supposed to be making public policy for us. And I challenge people, think about this. If we could just pick the size of the court, whether it be 5, 7, or 9, if we could just put robes on people and they could decide important public policy decisions without any input from the people, and they would decide what the level of income tax is, what the level of fuel tax, what the clean air standards would be, what public education would look like, what university standards would be. I mean, wouldn't that be a great country if we just delegated all that to people who wore robes and who were probably the least prepared, which I agree with Scalia on one of the clips we played on him. The judiciary is not prepared, not equipped, not qualified to make these public policy decisions in terms of significance. So it's not the court's role. It's not a question of being lazy. It's not their role to do that. Now, from a political perspective, since we do live in a political system, anybody who's holding public office, unless they're at the end of their political career, they don't seek to be in office anymore. And I can give you an example, like Alan Simpson, from Senator from Wyoming, when he finally got fed up being in the Senate. And he started talking about the Notch babies who were claiming they got beat out of Social Security money. And he called them greedy something another. I forget what his term was, but he said that there was nobody got cheated, that they were just simply greedy because they had to, there was a formula, a screw up in Social Security that paid those people way more than what it should have. And they corrected it. And it was a group of people that were born in certain years where they made the correction. And they didn't do it in all one fell swoop. So the Notch babies were complaining and he called them greedy. Well, The politicians are looking at this. Okay, I care about my schools in my state. I care about the environment. I care about seniors. I care about so many things that I'd like to do to make for a better future for. And I am not going to put my political future on the line by wanting to make things better for sex offenders so I can be vilified for doing that. That's just not in their DNA. They're not wanting to take that risk. So the comfortable position from an elected position of officials perspective is to have it forced down their throat by the courts. That's the most comfortable position for them, because they can say, well, you know, SORA, as they call it in Michigan, has been weakened, but we didn't do it. The courts did it. And they have plausible deniability that they didn't do the weakening.
Or even better, they could say that you know, if it hadn't been for their act, there would be no registry.
That's correct. And that's when they're going to act. And people keep wanting to know when the legislature is going to act. I'll tell you when they're going to act. When the courts finally decide that they can no longer enforce the status quo. If you've got the status quo still being enforced on 44,000 people, from a political analysis, there's absolutely no reason. There's nothing to gain from legislating, and there's everything to lose from legislating. The only way you could safely legislate would be you would have to make Michigan's SORA tougher. But if you do anything to relax the standards of SORA, you're going to be potentially vilified. So until they're faced with non-enforceability of the registry and the thing going dark, they have virtually no incentive to legislate. And I've said that from the beginning, and I had a lot of rotten tomatoes thrown at me when I said that. But that's the reality of the political situation.
Josh, is there an angle for the DA in there, the AG, Ms. Nessel?
Well, I mean, essentially, she's representing the state side of things, and at the same time, there's a separate case. I think it's called Betts, that's working its way through Michigan. That's similar and has some of the same kinds of questions. And I think, you know, what they've really, the state, oddly enough, has been in agreement on a large amount of the issues of Doe. Does, I'm sorry. And so I think we're going to win a pretty substantial victory in some sense. It's just how much of a victory. And really, the only thing the state's really pushing back on are things like their ability. They'd like to just be able to remove the unconstitutional parts and leave the statute the way it is. And they'd also like to have the Michigan State Supreme Court resolve the issue instead of Judge Cleland. And those are kind of the main issues. There's also an issue about the tier system having to be risk-based or not be risk-based. But for the most part, those are the main issues that the state is pushing back on. a great deal of the other stuff they're not really contesting, which is unique because our previous attorney general was basically pushing it even past the point where it made sense to push it.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is about Dana Nessel is I have at least read at least two. There was one like when she was elected roughly that she came out against that this whole situation is stupid. And then there was one even more recently, I guess it was an amicus brief, maybe?
Yeah, it was just last week, yeah. Those are all in the Betts case. And one other case has been going. So yeah, they're on separate tracks. And so she is definitely, it's very rare that you see the top law enforcement official in a state come out against the registry, kind of standing in the face of everything that Larry just said about elected officials. But she has done it not once, not twice, but now three times. And I definitely will always appreciate her for that. But it's odd that she's also has to represent the state in this Doe's versus Snyder 2 case.
Well, what I want to ask, I want Larry, I want you to chime in on this one, is that, as I recall, in the previous administration that Obama directed his attorney general, I don't remember who it was that Eric Holder perhaps, that said, can you hit these guys and gals with like drug offenses? Can you hit them with kid gloves, like shoot for minor stuff, shoot for diversion, whatever? And, you know, then so can the AG tell her DAs to then not go after the, you know, try to reduce sentencing, reduce the conviction, kind of the what is being convicted, being charged? Couldn't they kind of diminish everything just from that level without doing anything with the law?
It's a good question, but the analysis doesn't flow the same way because the U.S. Attorney General serves at the pleasure of the president. The state attorney general serves at the pleasure of the people.
Because it's an elected position.
It's an elected position. And the prosecutors in the state of Michigan, they're all elected in their own right. So they don't take direction.
Oh, there's no hierarchy, huh?
Yeah. There's no, President Trump decides that we have the attorney general that we have, which current is Barr. Right. Previously, you know who it was from Alabama, Sessions.
With advice and consent of the Senate.
With the advice and consent, which you're almost always going to get the consent of the Senate. And then the assistant U.S. attorney generals, you have a U.S. attorney for each district who answer theoretically to the Department of Justice in D.C., and then their assistants work under them. But you have a command structure where things flow from Washington in terms of directive policies. You don't have that in the state. The Kent County Prosecutor's Office doesn't answer to Lansing, to Attorney General Nessel. Whatever she wants, the Kent County Prosecutor comes out. Yeah, that's really nice. I appreciate your advice. But I answer to the citizens here in Kent County.
Yeah, and that definitely causes a lot of problems. You know, for instance, one of the problems that's happened over the last several years is that the Attorney General's Office definitely right now is not prosecuting people, for instance, for distance violations or whatever, but a local prosecutor could. And so what you'll get is a lot of times in the county, you'll get county prosecutors who are, you know, have their own kind of view on what should be done, and usually much more punitive on this issue. And so you do have a lot of inconsistency across the state.
Does the AG's office in Michigan have concurrent jurisdiction on prosecution of SORNA? Because in some states they don't. Like in Ohio, the AG has very limited prosecutorial powers. So can the AG bring those prosecutions?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Could you delve into that? I've never heard those terms before.
Well, the Attorney General oftentimes has very limited prosecutorial powers. If you look at a state and what the duties of the AGs, I don't even know how Georgia's is organized and what their responsibilities are. But what the AG is consistent, typically, they are responsible for defending the state's duly enacted laws, and they do consumer protection almost in all states I've ever lived in or been close to. They have they protect consumers from abuse and fraud and those. But in terms of being able to do prosecutions, the AG's offices are generally very limited. They don't have concurrent jurisdiction. If you think back a few episodes when we talked about Krasner, when Krasner said, I won't prosecute these things in Philadelphia, and then the conservative legislature, who says that they believe so much in local control and how much that they respect and admire the decision-making at the local level, they gave the attorney general power to do the prosecutions that they previously didn't have. So that's what I'm talking about. And Michigan,
I think I need that hypocrisy clip right now.
Yeah. We need that hypocrisy because they certainly are filled with it. But I don't know what jurisdiction, concurrent jurisdiction, the Michigan AG may have in terms of prosecutions.
Maybe we can travel down the path of, rolling back to when the decision was made by the judge saying these particular pieces were unconstitutional. Then what shouldn't that engage a mechanism to force the legislators to go legislate since they said it was unconstitutional? Is there any sort of mechanism that does that?
Not in the sense that you're talking about. The point is that a court, you're operating on separate tracks. So for instance, if I had been before this new case, Doe's 2, when we're back under Doe's, after Doe's 1 was decided, like I said, if I got picked up for like one of the things that have been found unconstitutional, the courts, when it, a local prosecutor might prosecute me for that, but the courts would then say, well, Doe's found this unconstitutional. That doesn't require the legislator to do anything. You know, that process happens independent of the legislature for the most part, unless they pass a new law. And as one of the legislators here in our legislature said, when they heard that the courts were, hoping that they would do something, is unless they start, driving tanks down to the Capitol, there's not much that's going to happen on SORN or on SORA. And, that's really what's played out. And so, what the real risk, I think what Larry said is true. The real risk is that Judge Cleland basically invalidates the statute. A large swath of the people on it, and then the legislator would have a lot of pressure on them to act, not because of the way it's going to play out in the courts. It's because the public would now see that they were allowing there to be no SORA.
And then the incentive would be to legislate, and they would follow the model in Pennsylvania. They would likely come in and try to recreate as much of it as they possibly could, knowing that they have the presumption of constitutionality, and they would try to reenact what had been what the judge has to halt enforcement. He has to not just declare it's unconstitutional. That's already been done. But the judge has to give a date certain when the lights will go out. And when that happens, if the judge says, you've got 180 days and I'm turning out the lights on this, then all of a sudden there will be an incentive to legislate. And then they will try to reenact and recreate as much of it as they can. Now, we can wish that they would have this epiphany that the ACLU is hoping for, and that they would like to believe that they're somehow going to come to believe that it's a bad public policy, and they're going to streamline the registry and remove a bunch of offenses from the registry, and they're going to do all these great things. I don't have much evidence to inspire me to believe that that's going to be the likely outcome, although I always hope I'm wrong when I make such a prediction. But I tell people, I don't say these things because I want to be cantankerous. I say these things because I want to tell you as best as I can on my life experience from a political analysis what they're likely to do. And what they're likely to do is to try to reenact as much of it as they possibly can so that they can be tough on people who've done evil things. That's what they're likely to do.
I mean, I know we both talked to Miriam. The only thing I'll disagree with, I think most everything you said I agree with there. With one exception, which is I don't think the ACLU's strategy was that they'll just have an epiphany and this is good public policy. I think that, A, they thought the original decision, at least at the immediate point, could serve as political cover. And B, if the judge were to invalidate the statute, do what you just said in terms of a date certain, although making it unconstitutional for the entire class would be a little bit of a different thing. But you're right that he'd probably have to do both. I think that the hope was that one of those two things would force the legislator to act. Since the first one failed, this is the second, because there was a working group and it involved the legislators, the state police, the attorney general's office, the governor's office. And that went on for quite a while. And there was some progress made, but it didn't end up doing much for the reasons you've already elucidated.
Well, when legislators are good people by and large, and when you go to them and say the courts have found a problem with something, the initial reaction is more likely going to be, well, what do we need to do? And so they're going to be very receptive to, oh, but then when you start getting into the nitty gritty of what you need to do, then they start putting a political analysis. Oh my gosh, no, I can't do that. Oh, they want us to, no, I can't do that either. And it's kind of like, I'll give you an example in the California with the tiered registry that California has lifetime registration for everybody. And then they decided they wanted, because the ballooning registry, everybody agreed, even the law enforcement people agreed that the registry had gotten too large in California, surpassed 100, 110,000, whatever the number is. And they wanted to find a removal process. Then they brought everybody to the table, the victims, advocates, and everybody to the table. And they created the most awful process that could ever be imagined. And not a soul will ever get off the registry under that process that they did. But they all agreed that there was a problem. So that's what you've got in Michigan. All these lawmakers are like, yeah, we've got a problem. But I can't help you with it because you're asking me to do something that's far too risky for me. I'm going to have the courts do this. I can't do what you're asking.
Believe
yes,
it or not,
the problem.
Process actually was moving pretty far along and a lot of progress had been made. My understanding of what ended up happening is what you know, part of what you're saying is correct, which is I believe, obviously wasn't in the room, but from what I've heard, it was actually the governor's office that got cold feet and decided to basically let the courts deal with it.
That's the safest posture to take.
Yeah. From a political standpoint, it's the correct.
Let me toss this out there. It seems that, let me try and make this comparison, that we continue to learn more about all things about the world. Science moves forward. New formulas are made, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Population increases. So there's always this like creeping forward. Is there ever a chance that laws roll backwards? I mean, it seems that every state in this case, every state in the United States is continuing to push forward and make it more. Where does it ever stop? Does ever someone go, this is good. It's got good enough. We don't have to do anything. It doesn't seem like that ever seems to happen.
In this particular instance, and Larry can certainly correct me, we're pretty much guaranteed that there's going to be a pretty drastic change for everyone who was sentenced before 2011 or was found, whose crime happened before 2011. I always keep saying sentencing, but it's actually the crime date. And I think that if there is a new constitution of the registry, as Larry said, it's mostly going to apply to people who were sentenced post the Adam Walsh Act implementation and only within the boundaries of this new kind of constitutional agreement. Because the one thing that the Doe's court did find is that all these elements that were ex post facto are also, invalid. And I imagine that the injunctive relief will have something to do with everyone who's been sentenced before 2011. And so if you made a bunch of new stuff, that would also be, it seems to me, ex post facto. I could be wrong about that, but I suspect it.
My expectation is it's going to go beyond 2011. And I believe that the disabilities imposed in 2006 with the restrictions on where people can live and work and be present and loiter, I think that those are going to be included in the relief and could turn out to be wrong. But I think the 2011 damage, where they lengthened the registration terms, to me was devastating. But what they did in 2006 was equally devastating when you can't live and work and be present places. So I think that the relief ultimately will go beyond what they did in 2011. But as Josh says, if your crime was committed after these dates, whichever one, if they focus on the 2006 or if they focus on 2011, whichever date is the cutoff where that tipped it to be unconstitutional, you're screwed until there's new litigation that proves that the registry is unconstitutional as applied to people who committed their crimes after one of those dates.
Yeah, it's going to be there are going to be things that get better for people post. I just use 2011 because it's the later date, but it's both 2006 and 2011. But for everyone post that, things might get mildly better, but it's not going to be the same kind of substantial relief under this decision, most likely.
Well, I think Andy was asking a question. I don't know if it was specific to the registry. Do things ever turn backwards? Yes. People, legislatures all over the country are recognizing that they've gone too far on criminal penalties. And they're pulling back and they're looking for alternatives. But in terms of the registry, I don't know that there's a lot of pulling back yet. I don't see that. I don't see the lawmakers pulling back. Now I see courts forcing, courts have forced I should say, they have enforced a change by judicial order. But as far as legislatures coming together and saying, well, gee, we're going to make an easier, better registry, none of those are coming to the top of my list of where the states have said we need to make this registry more lax. California, you might could cite that as an example because of the theoretically you can get off, but the process is so flawed that very few people are going to get off until they change that process. Missouri improved theirs where they made it in 2018 where people can get off, but the process is so flawed that very few will. So I guess there is some indication that it's marginally getting better, but not much is coming from legislative improvement. It's mostly coming from judicial, from courts.
I agree with that. I mean, I think we're in a situation where really over the last couple of years, I mean, I think about 3 years ago, we had a lot of flooding and, you know, I still think you've got the, you know, essentially the sex offender version of the William Horton problem, which is what we've been talking a lot about all night. But there was a lot of momentum, and I think over the last, you know, probably year and a half, I feel like a lot it seems like it's dissipating a little bit, and I don't feel like there's the same momentum as there was a couple years ago outside of the courts. I hope I'm wrong, but
I don't want to rehash this whole thing. I think we already covered it, but I wanted to, Larry and I, we talked about it earlier. I recall in some of the gerrymandering cases that have been going through the various levels of Supreme Courts, and then that sometimes the court has said, no, this is an unconstitutional districting map, gerrymandering setup. And they just said, you guys fix it. And then they give them some sort of amount of time. But other judges have then said no, and they actually kick back a redistricting map. They say, hey, this one works. Might not be what you want, but this one does work and accomplishes the goal of giving you districts that aren't gerrymandered. Could we not end up with a situation like that where the judge says, well, here's a constitutional registry that you guys could have to live with?
Well, I mean, I think that's what the Alaska case was in a way. But on your gerrymandering point, I feel like the problem with that analysis is that the Supreme Court ultimately kind of decided that they could, you know, that none of that they didn't care about the maps, period. But you know, back to your kind of example, I think we're, you know, I think that the best we had, and I think one of the things that's helped us is that they set sort of parameters. They said that the Alaska case was essentially, the Alaska registry was essentially, was constitutional. And the reason we've had success since then is because, like Larry said, people kept adding and adding and adding and couldn't let alone. And those are the things that have ultimately been found unconstitutional when they've been found unconstitutional. Am I wrong about that, Larry?
You're absolutely correct. And I would not want to see the day where the court starts writing the laws. That would be very frightening to me in our democratic system to have the courts writing the laws. What I would like to see the courts do is tell the state, well, you know, we've given you a lot of time and there's been no progress, so we're giving you one final deadline and the lights will turn out at that point. And you can figure out what you're going to do after that.
And when you say lights turn out, like, the website goes down with nobody listed and no violations for proximity violations go into effect?
Well, that's where the nuance comes, because my position is that the Michigan Supreme Court should accept a certified question because this is a state law. It's not a federal law. Michigan SORA is a state law. And whether or not state laws can be severed and survive in pieces, that is for the state. If it's not in the statutory scheme, and apparently it isn't, I haven't spotted it, no one's told me that it says that should any section of this be declared unconstitutional, remaining shall be enforced. That's for the state of Michigan's highest tribunal to guide the federal court, which is a court of limited jurisdiction, to tell them that we believe that this is that it can or cannot survive with severance. But if they sever the surviving portion, the unconstitutional portions, then that would mean that the people who had offenses that occurred before 2006, they could live and be present where they wanted to. That means that people were under the previous scheme where they were going to get off in 20 years, they would be back in that 20-year track. If they finish it, they would be done. So people who had been finished, who would have timed out on the old system, their registry would go dark. The people who had not timed out but had an obligation to report once a year or whatever the frequency was prior to the AWA, they would go back to what it was the law was like before the 2011 enhancements came in. So some people would go dark. Some people would still have a registration obligation, but it would be far less onerous because it would look like it did in prior to 2006. That's what I think the court should do, and that's what I think the court ultimately will do.
Yeah, I think the court's going to go farther than that, and I also think that they're probably – this is one thing here we were kind of arguing about before the show is, at least from what I understand from the hearing on Wednesday, you know, one of the big discussions is over if it should be remanded – I mean, if the Michigan Supreme Court should ultimately decide it or Judge Cleland should. And at least from the observers in the room and the lawyers in the room that I've talked to, they seem to feel like that decision was probably going to – remain with Judge Cleland, that he was probably going to go ahead and decide that himself. You know, if I'm wrong about that, you know, that's just hearsay. Obviously, I'm just getting information from people who were there. So,
well, people like to read judges and they like to interpret. And I do believe that Judge Cleland would be capable. He's got federal judges have very competent law clerks, and I think they can research Michigan's case law. And I think they can figure out whether it's severable based on existing case law. Being that I like to be conservative and not have, if I were a judge, I wouldn't want myself subject to being overturned. I wouldn't want to give the Attorney General of Michigan something to appeal. Now, I don't know if Nestle would appeal, but I wouldn't want to give them that. I would want to go through the most careful thought process to make sure that there's not an appeal to the Sixth Circuit on this. Cool. And I would want to give the court a chance to take the certified question.
Although you have to remember that I think all the parties understand that the Sixth Circuit is extremely sympathetic to the ACLU's case. In fact, at the end of the Sixth Circuit decision, they said, we also think a lot more of this is unconstitutional, but you haven't brought me that case yet. So if you want to keep bringing stuff, we'll listen.
Well,
I mean, it's not like they're a hostile audience. And that was one of the more conservative judges on the court.
I'm just telling you from a strategy standpoint, Nestle could die in a plane crash tomorrow, and the AG's office demeanor could change completely overnight. And if I'm sitting as a U.S. district judge, and I never will be, but if I were sitting as a district judge, I would want to give every deference to the state to tell me before I make, because I may be turning thousands of people off the registry. And taking them outside the zone of public scrutiny. And before I do that, I want a little bit of cover also, though I don't need it. But I want to make sure that every T has been crossed, every I has been dotted. And the thing about it is that the judge has waited so long, given the state all this opportunity to legislate, which they were never going to legislate. He's probably going to feel pressure now to not wait longer, because while this certified question is going up, that would cause another delay. And if I were the ACLU, I'd be arguing, Judge, I mean, we've waited since, what was it, May of 2019?
Oh, they're making that argument for sure.
That's what I would be saying, that, you know, we've waited long enough. We don't have time for a certified question.
Yeah, they said way too much damage has been done already. You know, we need injunctive relief, all that. Definitely right about that.
So
have we missed anything?
We haven't missed a thing.
I didn't think so. Josh, is there anything else that you think that we should dive into on this before we call it quits?
No, just everyone should keep their fingers crossed. This is a pretty big decision. So we got to
Well, let me ask you this, Larry. Obviously, this has no impact on any other state, but at the same time, it has a huge impact on other states. What would be the impact of them rolling things back on another state?
Well, I think I would say that this actually does have impact. This case is cited probably more than if you did a search time. It briefs this thing is cited in the Sixth Circuit case, Doe versus Snyder. It's cited repeatedly, and it's only binding in that territory, the Sixth Circuit, but it's very persuasive.
That's what I mean. So it doesn't have any direct impact on states outside of those, but like you said, it's persuasive. So this could affect a Georgia, could affect a New Mexico, whatever, in pushing, rolling things back to some 2006-ish level of situation?
It very well could if the Michigan legislature chooses not to legislate and the courts just simply say you can't enforce, if there's enough of a SORNA left, a SORN as they call it there, or SORA, I think they call it there, but if there's enough left that they simply say you're going back to where it was in 2006, then that would be monumental, because I'd like to roll ours back to where we were prior to 2005.
And does that set some sort of standard for what it would be, and then all of the states could file lawsuits to roll them back to some level like that?
Well, it doesn't set a standard because it's not binding, but it gives a framework of legal analysis for judges who are skittish to look at and say, well, wow, this was thoroughly analyzed and by this panel in the Sixth Circuit, and it seems pretty good to us.
Yeah, it's so hard to conceive of, and I use this expression all the time, but we are 50 quote-unquote individual little countries, and then we have the appeals courts and then the district courts, whatever, and then the Supreme Court. So, like, everybody is their own little operating entity, and it's so hard because we can just travel so freely that it's just fluid and we just bounce around, get on a plane, and you're in a different time zone in a different state. It's no big deal. That these things are isolated and encapsulated in their own little regions, and they do and they don't have influence on others. It's really hard to conceive of, really.
It really,
except that all of us know that when you get on a plane and you go to another state, you have to learn the rules of the other state.
No kidding. That's very true. And watch out for the Geiger counters, Larry. We had a conversation about some Geiger counters, didn't we?
We've had that conversation before. That Josh, do you know what the Geiger counter detects?
You've lost me on Geiger counters. I know what a Geiger.
Well, if a state has a particular number of hours that you can be physically present before you have to register, the Geiger counter goes off when you go 1 minute past that.
Ah.
And then it has to be, and I know you haven't seen this movie, Larry, but Monsters, Inc., that they had the little detector thing that if you had any of the humans on you, so they had like a detector to detect the human stuff. Anyway, just kind of silliness. I'm sure you've seen Monsters, Inc., Josh.
I have, and I do know what you're talking about.
And then after the Geiger counter reacts, then a hovercraft appears.
Yes.
And the hovercraft hovers over you until they apprehend you.
Now, and look, to go ahead, Josh, go.
Is it kind of like one of those alien movies where they suck you into the machine or what?
Sure. We play light on the situation that if you go to a state, let's just say you go to Florida where they have like the stupid 48 hour requirement and you're 1 minute over. Yes, you are violating the law. And yes, there's a huge penalty for it. But does anybody know if you drove into the state? Like, how do they know when you actually crossed the line? Like, anyway, we're playing fun with it.
I was just going to say, I also really hate these laws that where, you know, strict liability laws in general, there's no harm done to anybody, but they're still strict and harsh penalties. That's just very problematic to me.
So. Yes, and we're poking fun at the extreme nature of what you've just described, and we're poking fun at it, and someone kind of gave us some crap about it, I guess.
Well, and it's a serious thing because the law is on the books in some states that being physically present does trigger a registration obligation. The point we're trying to make is you assign yourself a far level, higher level of importance than that. First of all, they're not following you with a hovercraft. They don't know. And it would be rare that they would come into contact with you. And if they did, I have never seen a case where a person's been prosecuted for being on the 49th hour of a 48 hour limit if they're visiting. Now, I have seen cases where people have been prosecuted for being over the 3 days where you have to register. If you become a resident, or if you become a student, or you become whatever that triggers a finite, you become attached to a state. But of all the horrors out there, and being on the national defense lawyers list, being on the state defense lawyers list, and all the attorney contact I have not been able to unearth a case of a person having been prosecuted for being slightly over the amount of time they can be physically present. Now, I know law enforcement has too many resources, and they prosecute for a little stuff. I get that. But I would think that I would have heard about such a case. What I do hear about is they tell people, you got to get registered. But I've never heard of a prosecution of a person. You're 49 hours, and that's 60 minutes too long. I haven't heard of that.
Yeah, well, I'd hate to be the first case.
Yeah, you're the dummy test. But, you know, we cover that article with the guys, the handyman's going in there to change a light bulb, and they got arrested.
So, But
well, we should shut it down. Josh, who do you have that you are interviewing in the near future?
Well, I've done quite a few interviews in advance. I guess I'm pretty excited that I have an interview with Wayne Kramer. Many people might not know, but was the guitarist for a band called the MC5, who was pretty much one of the foundational bands in kind of what became garage rock and then punk rock, influenced a very wide range of artists, including The Clash. In fact, they wrote a song about him. And then later he went to prison. And then when he came back out, he kind of had a really good reclamation story. So it's fun to talk to him. I'm about to do a big episode on the crisis in Mississippi, where 15 people have died in the last like month and a half. And I'm having a bunch of the activists who have been really working on the ground and some folks from the Reform Alliance. I'm sure everyone's heard Jay-Z and some other rappers sued the state of Mississippi over this. And so I'm going to have someone from Reform Alliance, which Jay-Z is one of the owners of that.
And that's where the governor said that the cell phones are what caused all that.
Yeah, and I've been pretty much one of my least favorite arguments in the world is Department of Corrections argument that cell phones are the cause of violence. It really bothers my soul. They make that argument to the point where I usually explode on Twitter. If anyone follows me on Twitter, you've probably seen that. I think I even have graphics on it now that one of my people made or something like that.
We categorically rejected that just at last episode or the episode before. It's the silliest thing I've ever heard.
I have a clip of it. It's really quite funny. It's very humorous to me that he says, the gangs are using the cell phones to do these things. Like, okay, all right.
Anyone who's been in prison knows you can use the regular phones to do that just the same
way. Yeah, no kidding. It's just a lot more expensive to do it that way.
Sure, but they don't care.
I know.
So, I mean, they've been doing bad things, the gangs getting around to all the prisons in an entire state pretty much as long as there's been prisons.
Yeah, you're not allowed to have weapons either, but somehow that works out too. I'll tell you a quick little story. When I first got to this particular place in Georgia, and it was like a war zone. There was no staff oversight going on, and I'm doing some detail, cutting grass, whatever. And we're walking down the whatever the heck they call the thing, grinder. What the hell? I don't remember what they call it. Anyway, and passed by somebody on a yard, and he's just filing down some piece. Like, does not anybody see the guy making the shank on the yard now? I was baffled. All right, we got to get out of here. I know, right? Josh, thank you so much. Tell us again where we can find your programs and follow you on the Twitters and stuff.
Sure, decarcerationnation.com or iTunes, Google Play, or any of those places. And then my Twitter is at Joshua Beho, H-O-E.
Very good. Larry, as always, you are the man, the myth, the legend. You have all the informations, and I greatly appreciate you hanging out with us on a Saturday night again.
It's my pleasure to be here, and I appreciate all the listeners that are stacked up in Discord now and all those who are going to be listening the coming week. That for some reason or another, they just keep coming back. I don't know why.
They do. I always thank them and appreciate that they're there because they feed questions and make my job easier. Go hit the show notes at registrymatters.co and you can find where to contact us on Twitter, watch us on YouTube, download the podcast, all of that handy dandy stuff. And with that, Josh, thank you again. I appreciate it. And Larry as well. Thanks, guys. Have a great night.
Good night.
You too.